here. The Lord of hosts delivered our hands Og. He was the last of them hanging on to it, you see. Og, the king of Bashan, came out to battle against them. And the Lord delivered unto our hands Og also, the king of Bashan, and all his people. And we smote them until there was left, until none was left to him remaining. And we took all the cities. That time there was not a city which we took not from them. Therefore, 70 cities, all the region of Argob, the kingdom of Gob and Bashan. And we utterly destroyed them. Notice this happens in the book of Ether too, you know. Utterly destroyed them, as we did Sihon, the king of Heshbon. Utterly destroying the men, women, and children of every city. It is the same thing you have in Mormon. You say, well, where were the women and children after Gomorrah? They were in it too, you think. But all the cattle, all the spoil of the cities we took for prey ourselves. You notice what Chadwick says, and what Kramer says and so forth about the heroic age. It's a cattle culture. They drive cattle because you can move them along with you. You can still be mobile and raise cattle. So all the wealth is in form of cattle. This says here, but all the cattle and spoil of the cities we took for a prey to ourselves. And then Og, the king of Bashan. Well, and here's a typical example. Then we came to Mount Hermon, which Hermon the Sidonians call Siron. Now Sidon, the most common city name in the Book of Mormon, Sidon was the great on the coast Sidon. It simply means fishing rock. It was an old fishing rock, and it was settled by Canaanites, which you find people up there in the Rosh Hashanah fragments. And that's where Rosh Hashanah is up there. They've left us a big library, what they were doing up there. But the Sidonians call it Siron, and the Amorites call it Shinir, and we call it Hermon. See, everybody's moving around. They give their own names to these places, pushing each other out and so forth, the king of God. And then the Lord distributes them all. He gives the West Desert to the tribe of Half-Manasseh, and they're the Book of Mormon ones. Remember, Lehi's people come from east of the Jordan, from beyond Jordan. And so this is the way things go here. And they practice the usual Shrekishkeit to terrify them. Remember in the Book of Mormon, Shiz, the people are terrified of Shiz. He sweepeth the earth before him. Coriantumr, they develop this because it's very effective. Of course, they have their design, they wear masks. And that's why they wear the horns and the wings and all that nonsense. It makes them very impressive, you see. And they sweep the earth before them. Well, we'll see that in a minute. But here I noticed here, just looking at 225, where it says, "This day will I begin to put the dread of thee and the fear of thee upon the nations that are under the whole of heaven. Thou shalt hear report; they shall hear a report of thee, and shall tremble and be in anguish because of thee." Terror, Schrecklichkeit. That's a deliberate policy of the German General Staff. We must inspire terror. We must paralyze the enemy before we even hit him with our overwhelming terror and might. You see, and that's the thing that always begets a heavy opposition, unity among the opponents. And then again, he says here, "And we took the cities at that time and utterly destroyed the men and women and the title and the little ones of every city. We left none remaining, only the cattle we took for prey to ourselves and the spoil of the cities which we took." So that's the system we find here already. Israel was born in that system. This is the pressure cooker in which Israel came into existence. Now so we have a Jaredite society, and this is what it is. Just to save us some trouble here, we'll read some passages. Now you'll notice, you read your book of Jared and your book of Ether, and you find the whole history is a tale of fierce and unrelenting struggle for power. It's dark with intrigue and violence, strictly of the Asiatic brand. When the rival for the kingdom is bested, he goes off by himself in the wilderness, bides his time, he gathers an army of outcasts. This is done by drawing off men to himself, by bestowing lavish gifts and bribes. There's a nice summary of the whole thing here. I might read it to show you what utter nonsense is going on and how completely authentic it is. Where do we have that here? Oh, yes, thunder and following and so forth. I got it here. Now, you say you can't believe this, but just wait a minute. This is the normal course of history, I assure you. It's absolutely outlandish, but it's the thing we're coming into today. We're the only people that are in for it, but we're determined to do it. To get into this rat race. Yeah. This is the story here. This is the cycle running from the unity of nation to division, conflict, hence paralysis or extinction. It's repeated a dozen times. There are, yeah. The story round begins with Korihor, the great-grandson of the original Jared. He rebelled against his father, the king, and he moved out of the land and drew away many people after him, Ether 7 and 4, until he had an army that was able to beat the king and take him captive. The king's captive, his army, Korihor, takes over. Korihor was now what he wanted to be, number one, until his brother, Shul, beat him and restored the kingdom to the father again, who became number one. Then Korihor does a surprising thing. He repents, and Shul gives him a share of the kingdom. That's the first time around. Each cycle ends with repentance. Later, Korihor's sons rebelled and, quote, drew away all his brethren and many of the people, 7:15, whereupon he captured Shul and became number one again until the sons of Shul conspired and murdered him. And then Shul became number one. At least we've got rid of Korihor now. How many times has he been back and forth? Until his rule, there came prophets. That reminds me, I went sound asleep in priesthood yesterday, so I don't blame you for doing the same. Under his rule, there came prophets telling the people to repent or be destroyed. And the people did repent and prospered. Then later one, Jared, did flatter many people until he gained one half of the kingdom. From his father, Omer, he took it. His sons beat Jared, though, and reinstated Omer as number one. To get back the kingdom, though, Jared formed secret combinations bound with oaths. The oaths were given by them of old. See, this is the archaic system. It's already, Jaredites, when they came over here, already represented an ancient civilization. Don't try to fool around with chronology here. Were given of them by old, oaths were given by them of old who also sought power to help such as sought power to gain power. Notice that is the thing everybody's after here. I like this power business. Then, Jared was killed by his son-in-law, Achish. Then Erkash, wary of his own son, starved him to death, whereupon another son left the country and joined the deposed king Omer and his followers. Achish was a hard man to beat because he'd won the hearts of the people by knowing just what they wanted. The people of Achish were desirous for gain, and Achish was desirous for power, fair exchange. But his sons could also play the game, and with money. They drew away the more part of the people after them, 9-11, you see. The war ensuing encompassed the destruction of nearly all the people of the kingdom. When it gets fairly well restored, then we come to one Heth, who began to embrace the secret plans again of old to destroy his father, 9:26. He slew him with his own sword and did reign in his stead. And the prophets enter again and say the people would be destroyed if they didn't repent. There was a terrible drought and famine, and that brought repentance until one Morianton gathered together an army of outcasts. This is the thing to notice. This is the standard Asiatic procedure. An army of outcasts, and after the long war, he did gain power over all the land and did establish himself over king of the land. He was a very good king, surprisingly. And his son and successor, Kim, was captured by his brother, who became number one. But Kim's son, Levi, gets rid of the brother, you see, made war against the brother, and thus he became number one. He was also a good king. Surprise, surprise. Then Kalm comes along, whose father had lost the kingdom and been in prison for 24 years. He drew away half the kingdom after 40 years. He challenged the king of the other half to a duel. Amgid. Following a long war, Kalm obtained power over the remainder of the kingdom. His son, Shiblon, which means young lion, slew the prophets who'd stated the proposition that the people must repent to be utterly destroyed. So there you are. Well, this is not through yet. Then we're in 11 and 13 now. From that time on, it was all downhill. A mighty man led a revolt against the king, kept half the kingdom for many years until the king overcame him, became number one. Then another mighty man took him captive. Again, many prophets came and so forth. They would be destroyed. Then the thing became a free-for-all, quote, with many who rose up who were mighty men, 13:15, all zeroing in on King Coriantumr, but he was a great survivor. He knew how to handle things like that. And the war ceased not. Sherrod put Coriantumr in captivity. Coriantumr is now the king, but he's now in captivity. Clever as he is, and Sherrod becomes number one until Coriantumr's son frees and restores Coriantumr to that glorious position. By then it was a complete breakdown with, quote, 13:25, every man with his band fighting for that which he desired. Coriantumr and Sherrod became obsessed with the necessity of ridding the world of each other. Well, when Sherrod was defeated, when Sherrod defeated one of Coriantumr's army, he raced to the capital to put himself on the man's throne. But the process of polarization then began in earnest. Coriantumr gathered great strength to his army in the space of 2 years, while Gilead, the brother and successor of Sherid, was doing the same, assisted by secret combinations. Dangerous associations, however, they soon murdered Gilead and then liquidated his murderer, while a giant by the name of Lib, you still have the giants there, the giant by the name of Lib became king. He was killed fighting Coriantumr, but his brother continued the feud and with a famous Shiz. So it's now Shiz versus Coriantumr. The people began to flock together in armies throughout all the face of the land, and they were divided. A part of them fled to the army of Shiz, a part of them fled to the army of Coriantumr. Always this steady, progressive process of polarization goes on. And then, suggesting the formal set battles of epic literature and the Middle Ages, as like a chess game, the Shiz retreated. He swept off the inhabitants before them, all them who would not join him. That's the way you do it. Meanwhile, Coriantumr gathered to his army upon Hill Cumnor and did sound a trumpet to the armies of Shiz to invite them forth to battle. All this is formal. All this is exactly the way things have been done for thousands of years. After losing millions of people in battles, Coriantumr began to repent and wrote to Shiz, desiring that he would share the people. He said Shiz would agree on this condition, 15:5, if Coriantumr would give himself up, that Shiz might slay him with his own sword. Pharaoh does that. We have the earliest pharaohs cutting off the head of the rival prince. Well, you get the beautiful picture here. Now, let's look at the Jaredite society here and see what happens. Yes, let's look at the Asiatic society. I notice I have, not here, but later. I just put a lot of references here to save us the trouble. Yes, 195. The whole history, as you see, is a fierce, unrelenting struggle for power. Now, I noticed I had out in the garage, I'd forgot I had a very valuable work. It's Arab Shah's Life of Tamerlane, Life of Tamerlane in Arabic, who was a contemporary, a secretary of Tamerlane. He can really tell you about that guy. The biography of the typical Asiatic conqueror with his dark allusions to supernatural and especially to the works of the devil. Strange and savage picture of nightmare politics, but Timur conquered the world, as you know. That was Tamerlane. The oldest records of the race, now we have some good sources here, but I don't know whether I should. Well, here they are when we quote them. The earliest records of the race, we find the supreme god, founder of the state, and quote, winning his way to the throne by battle, often by violence against family predecessors. That's the only thing we've been finding. The son, his son or his brother, or their brothers, or his father, bumps off his father, winning his way to the throne by battle, often by violence against family predecessors, which generally involves horrific and obscene incidents. The abominations of the ancients. I'm going to see who I was quoting there. Yes. Oh, that's von Gaal. Yes. The abominations of the ancients, about which Ether has a good deal to say, are thus seen to have respectable antiquity. Well then, empires must have been formed and destroyed then as they were later on, says, in his history. Well, the great Eisler is talking there. Have I got the right section here? No, I haven't. Ah, here's the one. I'm just curious, I want to look up. I can remember most of these, but some, yeah. These sorts are important, because this is what went on. Empires must have been formed and destroyed then as they were later on. The familiar such empires then, we're quoting McGovern here, were not the result of gradual expansion or development, no evolution here, but rapidly became enormous empires under the leadership of a single great man. See, always number one. It's the big thing. And under the reign of his successors, slowly but surely declined, though in many cases they disintegrate immediately after the death of their founders. Founder dies. So you find ghost towns all over Central Asia, settled by these people. The fugitive who gathers forces in the wilderness by drawing off people, this is the way you do it in the Book of Ether, drawing off people from his rivals, is a strictly conventional figure on the steppes. That's the way a very great every great conqueror begins. Liu Feng, I suppose we should write these down. I have some better ones later on. Well, Liu Feng, quote, the leader of a small military band, half soldiers and half bandits, nearly won the whole Hunnish and Chinese empires for himself 2,000 years ago, and would have done so had not some of his own ambitious officers deserted him just as he had deserted others. Now, we all know this one. It was after cheating his brother of the throne that Attila sought to subdue the foremost nations of the world, and after his death, two of his descendants went out into the wilderness where they gathered about them armies of outcasts, each hoping to win back the world empire for himself. Same process going on, you know. You will remember that Genghis Khan, lived for years as an outcast and a bandit, as he gathered around him forces that were to conquer all his rivals. Those forces were actually drawn off from the armies, the rivals themselves. Under the nomad system, quoting somebody else now, the leaders of the Bagadurs and Noyans, tribal chiefs, strove to become independent by attracting subjects and followers of their own. They have a name by that, it's Jadaba, the Jadab, the Arabs use that name, to draw away people to yourself and build up a following. That's what you do in politics too. The great ruler of Asia have regularly passed from the risky station of bandit chief to hardly less risky one of world monarch and back again, where every man, now we're quoting from, here's another one I have out in the ground, Aksarai's History of the Seljuk Turks, another Arab historian who's writing, contemporary. This is what he says, where every man is filled with the desire to become an independent prince, and every prince to become the lord of all. This is ambition, this is power, what we're talking about here. The boldest adventurers, we're quoting again, the boldest adventurers flocked eagerly to the banner of the new and successful chieftain of every race, in the beginning as in our old day, when all the youth of Central Asia, now this happened in the 1920s, believe it or not, when all the youth of Central Asia rallied to the standard of 15-year-old Ma Chung-ying as he calmly worked out a plan for the conquest of the whole world and nearly succeeded in a large part. 15 years old, remember? Mormon was 15 years old when they chose him to be younger. The bandit Pal Natoki conquered all the Baltic states, the Eastern Plains, the terror of the North, 12 years old. What goes on here? These people are real prodigies. Calmly, well, they've been raised in that, of course. Well, not only is the Jaredite practice of seeking to draw off one's side the followers of a rival while building up an army in the wilderness, the best Asiatic tradition, the method of doing it is likewise accepted tradition. Thus, Akish bound his followers. Now, this thing about Akish is very much worth noticing here. I've got to tell about it here. Let me see. Oh, yes. Let's go here. You know how the story about Akish, well, this is the way it goes. He bound his followers around the nucleus of his family by lavish gifts, for the people of Akish were desirous for gain, even as Akish was desirous for power. Wherefore, the sons of Akish did offer them money, by which he drew away the more part of the people after them. It was the sons of Chinggis Khan who did most of his campaigning for him, is the way, same way as Akish. And from the very beginning, the secret of his power was the huge heaps of precious things that always stood near his throne, and from which, after immemorial custom of the steppes, he rewarded all who joined him. In the 6th century, Menander, a Roman ambassador to the court of the Grand Khan, that was long, 600 years before Chinggis Khan, Menander beheld 500 wagons full of gold, silver, and silken garments that accompanied the monarch on his wanders. For the ancient law of the Khans, he says, was that none enters the presence of the ruler empty-handed, nor departs unrewarded. That was good king, as Beowulf said. The good king is the one who gives, but he also receives. You don't enter ever, the pharaoh apply the same thing. You never enter the presence of majesty without a gift, and you never depart without a gift either. The pattern of steppe imperialism, according to Vernadsky, who wrote the standard work on the primitive Russian Empire, begins with accumulated wealth in the hands of some able chieftain, which enables him to expand his popularity among neighboring clans. And they all talk about the dedicated zeal with which the men of the steppes devoted themselves to two objects, power and gain. You may have heard that formula before, Book of Mormon. They're inseparable, of course. That quality is peculiar to Jaredite society appears from the fact that the twin motives of power and gain receive far more attention in the Book of Ether than anywhere else in the Book of Mormon. It came to pass that Akish gathered unto himself the house of Jared, all his kinfolk, and said unto them, will you swear unto me that you will be faithful unto me? Now, the only way you can bind them together, this all the authorities note too, always, how can you bind a person to you who's riding a horse and is free to gallop off in any direction he wants, in the night or any other time? You have to bind him by something, and it can't be by putting guards over him. You can't watch people. What you do, you swear them by oaths, these terrible oaths. That's why from Central Asia come these most awful and frightful oaths, because the only way you can bind a person to you. So it says here, he will swear unto me that you will be faithful unto me in the thing which I shall desire of you. How can he count on them? Came to pass that they all swear unto him by the God of heaven and also by the heavens. You notice, Genghis Khan comes in the Siobogu, the God of the blue heaven. He swears his oaths by the blue heaven. the God of heaven. He calls himself God, the Susapogo, I think it's called, yes. And also by the earth, and by their heads, that whoso should vary from assistance which Achish desired should lose his head. And Achish did administer to them the oaths which were given by them of old, who sought power, which had been handed down from Cain. This is the normal course of history, alas, to say that. The very oldest text in the language of the world, according Fritz Hommel here, were incantations, having the stereotyped conclusion, let it be sworn by the name of heaven, let it be sworn by the name of earth. The flood of documents that came forth in recent years teach us the ways the men, the dawn of history, bound people by oath and so forth, the Enuma Elish. Well, you know, the Enuma Elish, the text is from the old Babylonian kings, very old, the oldest, but it goes back to the founding of the world. You see, that's the idea, it's their New Year celebration of the founding of the world. And there, Tiamat, aiming at the rule of the universe, draws off the gods to her side so that they conspire unceasingly day and night against the rightful ruler and gather themselves together in a host to make battle. When he heard the news, the true king sat upon his throne, grim and silent, without saying a word. He smote his thigh, he bit his lip, he controlled his voice, and finally gave orders to assemble his host, by which formal acclamation they all took the oath of allegiance to his leader, Marduk. This story goes back to the very beginning of things, actually. It comes from the first Babylonian dynasty, but its background is Sumerian. Well, we have the terrible oaths that are taken and broken. Here, for example, the king of the Comanes caused the emperor, for example, Nicephorus was the emperor. The king of the Comanes caused the emperor of Constantinople and their people to be blooded. Each drank alternately of each other's blood. This is the kind of oaths they would make, you see. Study of the oldest annals of Asia conducts us, as does the study of the oldest language, into a world of oaths and covenants. Well, we see why this should be so. And Mithra rules, says the Avesta, by virtue of his 10,000 spies. See, the Avesta's Iranian, that comes out of there. Which make him alone, of all kings, undeceivable. Is this the institution of the king's eyes and the king's ears, perfected by the Persians and inherited by the monarchs of many lands? The success of any conspiracy against watchful loyalty, you see, it has to be great secrecy. Great secrecy and surprise before our else. So we have the unfailing adjunct of nemesis of the Asiatic king is the secret society and surprise. That's what Napoleon says, secrecy and surprise. Well, that's what strategy is, to spring a surprise. Don't let the enemy know what you're doing. You can win by surprise. You must always surprise him. the normal constitution of the Asiatic Empire, Wright, Wart, and Delaporte, in their very large work on the subject, they've written a great deal on that, the French. Wart and Delaporte say, the normal constitution is, quote, despotism tempered by dethronement and assassination. That's the process, you see, in which the clergy play a leading role here. Well, that's the way things go. And here I notice I have some examples. I have 228, is it? Yes. This where I list the numbers. I listed 12, but I see where that is. Well, this is good anyway. This system of drawing off we're talking about. Say, there's an Arabic word for it, jadaba. From whom shall I take away the lawful sovereignty? Ask Mithra in the Avesta. And then the exchange of personal letters, that's important. Here's a good one, you see. Let Shan Yu come to the south and either meet the emperor in open battle or else become a subject and pay reverence to the imperial throne. That's a typical example. Jealousy and ambition, says Xenophon, March of the 10,000, way back in the 4th century BC. He marched right to the center of Asia, as you know. Jealousy and ambition, he says, are the essence of Asiatic kingship, which is an intensely personal thing. He describes how Croesus and Cyrus fought it out, the Kassite king. In the midst of the battle, my own hand captured Kashtiliash, the Kassite king, at the point of the spear, unto the setting of the sun, I waged battle. And of course, that vividly recalls the Book of Mormon, Shiz and Coriantumr, hacking away at each other until nightfall, and they'd sleep on their weapons, and then they'd go fighting away the next morning. And he says, now this is the Kassites taking over Babylonia at a very early time. He captured Kashtiliash, and at the point of the spear, unto the setting, I waged battle. And so, we have the same thing. The personal combat between kings. Shiz says, if you let me cut your head off, I'll spare your people, because they become his people. Then there's the challenge to each other. The king of the Massagetae, the king of the Scythians, sent his challenge to the king of the Massagetae, and also to the great Darius, whose father exchanged challenges with an early queen of the Massagetae, a famous queen, Tamiris. The king of the Visigoths challenged the emperor Honorius to a single combat, as did Lazarius, the king of Serbia, challenged Amurath the Turk, and so on. It goes on. And the great Khans, when their rivals were captured in battle, would personally behead them. That was part of the ritual, as Chinese generals still do to other Chinese generals, that is, when this was written. And so again, this is all right out of the Book of Ether, you see. And drinking out of the skulls and so forth. And sweeping off the... Now, wars of extermination. I used to think that was an exaggeration, but don't fool yourself. Remember, we're told they swept off the inhabitants before them, all they that would not join them, Ether 14 and 17. All right, now, here's what... I think this is what Arab Shah writes. If the neighboring province to that which they invade will not aid them, says an eyewitness of the Tartar technique, they waste it, and with the inhabitants whom they take with them, they proceed to fight against other provinces. That's where they sweep them and build up their armies. They place their captives in the front of the battle, and if they fight not courageously, put them to the sword. In such a way, the Asiatic warlords from the beginning swept the earth before them like shiz. The communists of our own, hordes of our own day did that, forcing all that lay in their path to become part of them. I counted them among my people, says the Assyrian conqueror of one nation after another. This ancient formula goes back to our old friend Nimrod. And we're told of Genghis Khan, he became a mighty, well, Carpina says, Genghis Khan, like Nimrod, became a mighty hunter. He learned to steal men and to take them for prey. He ranged into other countries, taking many captives if he could and joining them to himself to build his army. He bound them, as Nimrod had done, by awful oaths. The system was sweeping the earth. And the Shrekish kite we mentioned here. Coriantumr here for Eleuther 14, 17, and 18. Coriantumr did slay both women and children, and he did burn the cities, and there went a fear of Shiz throughout all the land. Yea, a cry went forth throughout the land, who can stand before the army of Shiz? Behold, he sweepeth the earth before him. The policy of Shrekishkeit, which the Germans cultivated very deliberately. When Coriantumr gained the victory, it was his turn to be the terror of the earth, and the people began to be frightened and began to flee before the armies of Coriantumr. Frightened, you see. And then the robber bands, the efflorescence of robber bands. Remember, Mormon says finally, there's no one left in the land except Nephites, Lamanites, and robbers. Well, what happens, of course? All who won't join the great armies are put to death. But what of those who escape? You're not going to stay and wait for that. They're naturally outlaws, have no allegiance to any king, hence no rights or claims to protection. To survive, they band themselves together, since all are deserters whose heads are forfeit. Their behavior becomes very dangerous. Asia had at all times swarmed with robber bands, exactly as this is continent under the Jaredites. From time to time, these robber bands have formed coalitions strong enough to ruin states and overturn thrones. After the wars between the Mongols and the Mamluks had exhausted all their resources and brought many ruin to many lands, the soldiers from both sides banded together in robber armies, gathered up the outcasts from the desert and mountains, and came near to conquering all of Western Asia. The pages of Bar Hebraeus, who writes in Syriac and who is a merchant who made some great studies back there in the early days. The pages of Bar Hebraeus swarm with these robber bands and a good description of how they operate. Whenever central governments become weakened by wars and corruption, bands of robbers would appear as if out of the earth. And when early in the 9th century the robber Omar became the terror of the Near East and joining forces with the robber of Nasir in the north, he began to destroy the world, he said. They could join. Just as robber bands often formed the nucleus of world-conquering armies, some Chinese emperors had whole armies composed of what they called bad young men, whole armies. So those world armies, once beaten, promptly broke up into robbers' bands, while again their leader, lately a world chief, would find himself nothing but a bandit chief. The years during which Justinian and Chosroes were locked in deadly rivalry for the rule of the world, that's in the 6th century, 7th century, 6th century, 565, rise in Western Asia of a motley array of robber gangs numbering 12,000 men. They brought complete ruin upon a large part of the civilized world, and in the time of panic and insecurity, great schism fell upon the Arabs, the inhabitants, and in every land, in every quarter, a man rose up who did not agree with his companion. Notice, it was a wonderful contention. Remember, no Mormon says there were wonderful contentions. The whole face of the land was one complete revolution. Everywhere, one complete. The same condition you see with the Nephites. The book of, this, the only thing is that the Enoch, the Ether story goes back earlier. It covers more, and it is a neat packaging. It shows the system at work in one package. The Nephites and Lamanites were more civilized. Remember, they didn't like war too much, we're told. Mormon, they were very reluctant on both sides during the long war. So, but this is what happened. Typical and recurrent state of things vividly accepts the awful days of the Jaredite robbers, when every man slept on his sword to guard his property from every other man and still had it stolen. That's 14th chapter of Ether, Ether 14 and 2. See, these things are all there. In Taras Bulbag, Gogol's great novel, he describes the Kazakh hordes. Taras Bulbag was a Kazakh. Kazakh hordes is going quite insane in battle, as Ether puts it. Well, the pathological aspects, the hideous disguises, the bloody oath, the insane yells. They were drunken with anger, even as a man is drunken with wine, says Enoch, Ether, keep saying Enoch, Ether 15 and 22. One thing is a custom of collecting scalps, which came from there. The Indians didn't originate it. It was the Hamilton, the hair buyer, financed it in the French-Indian Wars here, but it comes from Asia. It was an Asiatic custom. You find it everywhere. And then now the insane wars leading to complete annihilation on both sides, with the kings the last to go. We've mentioned that before. The same thing had happened earlier in the days of Achish, when the war with people, population was reduced to 30 people, either 9 and 12. This all seems improbable to us, but two circumstances peculiar to the Asiatic warfare explain the phenomenon, which is paralleled everywhere. First, every war is strictly a personal contest between kings. It must continue until one of the kings is fallen or is taken. The second, things are so arranged that the king must be the very last to fall. So in that case, it's going to be extermination, isn't it? The whole army exists for the sole purpose of defending his person, the shield wall that you read about in the Eddas. This is clearly seen in the game of chess. We mentioned before, all the pieces are expendable except the king, who can never be taken. The Shah in chess, right, Mohandam, a Hindu expert on chess, the Shah in chess is not killed and does not die. The game is terminated when the Shah is pressed into a position from which he cannot escape. Well, Shahmat means the chief is dead. This is the line with all good traditions of chess playing, and back of it, the tradition of capturing the king in war rather than slaying him whenever this could be accomplished, unquote. You'll recall the many instances in the Book of Ether in which kings were kept in prison for many years but not killed, the code of medieval chivalry. And even so, Chiz was willing to spare all of Coriantumr's subjects if he could only behead Coriantumr. That was chess, you see, that was the typical, like the pre-dynastic maces from Egypt. A circle of warriors, Ether says 15 and 26 in Ether, Ether says, large and mighty men as to the strength of men that fought around their kings to the last man. It's described in Easter. And of course, way back, right down to the Battle of Flodden Field in 1525, where Scott describes the same sort of thing happening with the Highland Scots who never get civilized, fighting around the wall, around their king, a fierce but fading fire, he says. Represent that same institution, the sacred shield wall, which our own Norse ancestors took over from Asia and which meets us again and again, the tribes of the war. The king actually was the last to perish. So, to cite a few examples here, here I have some. When Genghis Khan overcame the great Merkit nation, which was his great rival for all of Central Asia, he left only one man alive, the brother of his favorite wife. Again, the Syrian kings, like the Romans, flooding the sites of cities they destroyed to convert them into uninhabitable wastelands. In cities of a million inhabitants, the Mongols left not a dog or a cat alive, and they converted vast provinces to complete deserts. The great island of Cyprus was uninhabited waste for 7 years after the Turkomans took it. The Goths, in a single battle, entirely exterminated the great tribe of the Scyri, as the Huns did the Scythians and Alans, and the Mongols did the Tartars, their own kinsmen. Oh, wait, the Mongols, it was the Mongols' turn next. As the remember what Mormon says, after we've taken care of, the Gentiles have taken care of the Indians, it will be their turn next. Well, here it goes, you see. Some did to the Mongols, did to the Tartars. The Mongols themselves met retribution in 1732 when their own kinsmen, the Manchus, wiped out 9/10 of the Orient Mongols in a Chinese-inspired project aimed at completely obliterating both sides. Chinese are very clever, you see. They're threatened by the two tribes, the Manchus and the Mongols, and their cousins, so they just put them to fighting against each other, and that leaves the pressure on China. But it was extermination. Such mutual suicides of the nations were not uncommon. The Kin and the Siasia, their two Hunnish tribes, the Kin and Vast, the two greatest empires of their day, so closely related in blood as were the people of Chiz and Coriantumr, they engaged in 15 years of warfare which wiped out 18 million people. a figure that makes Ether's 2 million people, and Ether 15 and 2 seem rather paltry. 15 to 2 million killed in the last extermination. Incidentally, the wars of Genghis Khan cost China alone 40 million lives. These people don't fool around, do they, when they wipe them out? They do in vast numbers. The Hunnish Jiao dynasty of the north and the Qin empires of the south almost achieved neutral quietus during a civil war in which, quote, neither side was willing to make peace until the other was completely crushed. In the first century BC, the Huns divided into to follow two brothers, following two brothers in the good old Theridite fashion, Jiji and Huhanxi. 20 years of war followed, and the deadlock was only broken in 43 BC when Jiji's people in despair finally fled to the west in the best Jaredite manner after leaving vast stretches of land bare and deserted behind them. That's a quote. So this is the sort of thing. When the Jaredites left down these bones littering the land, what the Jaredites left behind them was a land littered with bones. For, quote, so swift and speedy was the war that the whole face of the land was covered with the bodies of the dead, 14 and 12. And a generation later, their bones lay scattered in the land northward. You read in Omni back in the Book of Mormon earlier, you see. A medieval traveler passing Kif, years after the great wars between the Mongols and the Russian hordes, reports, quote, when we were traveling through this country, we found an innumerable multitude of dead men's skulls and bones lying about upon the earth. Far away in Kumania and Kanglei, the same traveler says, we find many skulls and bones lying on the ground like cattle dung. All the living inhabitants, he notes, were reduced to slavery. Where burial was at all possible after the great battles, the only practical procedure was to heap up the bodies in great piles and cover them with earth, as the Book of Ether says, like dung, erecting great tumuli over them. The entire Naiman nation, this was a great nation, the entire Naiman nation was thus buried after its destruction. Joinville, who accompanied St. Louis in the 14th Crusade, you know, well, the 7th, numerical, it was a catastrophic into Egypt there. Joinville traveled a whole year, he was the secretary of Baldwin, Jerusalem, traveled a whole year through Asia to reach the court of the Khan of Tartary. He saw along the road of the Tartar conquest large mounds of bones, he says. A careful comparison of the prehistoric minds of Asia and America is in order. So this is the pretty picture we have here. And, I want to mention this, the daughter of Jared, the succession here. This we should talk about, we should mention this here too. This Salome episode. The story of Jared's daughter. This was later Jared who rebelled against his father and did flatter many people because of his cunning words until he had gained half the kingdom and did carry away his father into captivity after defeating him in battle and did make him serve in captivity. This happens again and again in the Book of Ether. You have time to go through here. In captivity, the king raised other sons who finally turned the tables on their faithless brother, beat his forces in a night skirmish. It was a palace coup. There's a marvelous description of that in Egyptian literature. They spared his life and promised to give up the kingdom, but they failed to count on Jared's daughter, an ambitious girl who'd read, or at least asked her father, if he had read in the records which our fathers brought across the great deep. All this was consciously carrying on the traditions of the old world. He says, "Have you read in the books we brought up with us of our fathers about the great deep, a very instructive account of those devices by which men of old got kingdoms and great glory." See, this was the process. "Hath he not read the record which our fathers brought across the great deep? Behold, is there not an account concerning them of old, how that they, by their secret plans, did obtain kingdoms and great glory? This is the law of succession they follow, you see. Now, therefore, let my father send for Achis, the son of Kimnor. Behold, I am fair, and I will dance before him, and he will please him, and he will desire me to wife. Therefore, Historically, we go on here. Historically, the whole point of the story is that it's highly unoriginal. It's supposed to be. The damsel asks her father if he's read the record and refers to him how them of old did this thing. It dealt with a pattern. And this is basic. This is what she tells him to do. And what Achis carries out is the very essence of what they called in Cambridge in the 1930s. You see, that's when I grew up in the 1930s. In Cambridge, they called it patternism. This is the pattern in which the princess dances. Well, there have been some good novels written about it. Marie Renault, The King Must Die, and so forth. There's some wonderful things about it. Patternism, because this is the pattern of royal succession that was followed, weird as it seems, you see, and this is it. In which a princess dances before a romantic stranger, wins his heart, and induces him to behead the ruling king, marry her, and mount the throne. The sinister daughter of Jared works the plan for all it's worth. Having got her grandfather beheaded and her father on the throne, she proceeds to marry the murderer, Achish, She wants him to be king now, so she gets her father murdered next, you see, who presently, having sworn by the oath of the ancients, the old system again, you see, obtained the head of his father-in-law as he sat upon the throne, Ether 9 of 5. And who put him up to the new crime? Quote, it was the daughter of Jared who put it into his heart to search up these things of old, and Jared put it into the heart of Achish, 8 and 17. At first she influenced Achish through her father Jared, but after Achish became her husband, she would of course act directly under her influence to dispatch her next rival. According to the ancient pattern, Ether insists this all goes back to the ancients. Well now, what comes next, of course? Achish, as soon as his successor became apparent, would be marked as the next victim, and he was. And surely enough, we find him so suspicious of his son that he locks him up in prison and starves him to death. But there were other sons, and so there, quote, there began to be a war between... See, this is the mother goddess who is permanent there, you see. As I say, it's been written up best by Marie Renault in some of her novels. She's done a good job of it. They began to wage a war between Achish and the sons of Achish, ended in the complete ruin of the kingdom. Many years later, the old evil was revived by Heth, who began to embrace the secret plans of old, dethroned his father, slew him with his own sword, and did reign in his stead. Well, now, oh, I have some. You see, this is a great subject. And so I'm going to give you the subject to write on for the final now. You write an essay on this. I'm sure you'll enjoy it. It's broad enough to take care of things. Here it is. Essay. Remember, it's the 23rd. That gives you 15 days. That gives you 2 weeks. And the 3rd at 3 o'clock. Another day, too. This is it. Now, this is about as broad as you can, but this is good. Or the title of it, In the Decline, that's an L, and Fall of the Nephites, of course. Nephites and Jaredites, we're going to add them. You can brood about that, you see. Something to make you really sad. I guess that's where you're right. Not Nephites. They're Nephites. Neph. Fights. And getting into very bad habits of writing. All my own notes I write in shorthand, so I don't learn to write. Essay, quote, this is the title. Lessons for the present, right? In the decline and fall, not of Rome, but of the Nephites and Jaredites, is the best decline and fall story we have. You notice how the Book of Ether starts out. These people who were destroyed on the face of the Northland. Nephi starts his story, destruction of Jerusalem. Moroni ends his, of course, with destruction. Pretty sad. It has lessons for us here. I don't think the Book of Mormon is fooling around.